Welcome back to Silk Flowers and
Paper Mache Hearts. We are your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. Last week, we talked with Natalie Taylor Hart about collaboration between scenic designing and prop mastering. And so this week, we want to focus on Natalie's own prop work.
Yeah, she has spent several summers at the Santa Fe Opera as both a crafts artisan and the assistant prop supervisor. And when we lived in New York, she built props for the Public Theater, Second Stage, Playwrights Horizons, NYU, Sleep No More, Space Design, several others. And she also spent a summer in Italy. Which town?
Abano Terme.
Okay. Learning traditional Commedia dell'arte mask making from
Donato Sartori.
Yes. This is the leather masks built over a wooden form using all traditional techniques that Donato has sort of rediscovered through his own research of how they would build masks. So we'll get into that towards the end of the episode.
So let's start off with a little bit of just where you kind of started to break into props and where you learned the most and what really pushed you in the direction of that world.
Okay. Well, like I was saying in the last episode, I've always done crafts since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there was a time when I was in college and even right out of college when I was mostly doing, I was teaching English and I didn't have anything crafty going on in my life. And I would just do stuff. Like I would buy a box and paint it or carve it or whatever. And I was really all self-taught. All of the art classes, and I regret this. I actually am looking into to more art classes, but all of the art classes that I've taken or through theater, we're not through like, you know, capital A art, visual arts. So I kind of started out there and then, you know, through theater started, you know, when I went to grad school learning tools and techniques and real things. And I always liked the crazy stuff. I said last night, my favorite was like, give me the one crazy thing to do, especially mixed media. I think my first like really big, exciting project, was the, I built deer haunches for a Lie of the Mind in grad school. And, I know you guys wanted to talk about those. Yes. They actually appeared, later on. Tom Fiocchi, the teacher there, still rents them out when people do Lie of the Mind. And they were, they were off Broadway in Ethan Hawke's production of Lie of the Mind many years later. But
yeah, I forget how that came about because I knew the props master who was doing the show and he was looking for deer haunches. And so he had got a hold of Tom Fiocchi, or maybe I had hooked him up with Tom Fiocchi. Somehow they got together, but I knew all of this. And then I was like, it was Matt Hodges. And I was like, Matt, you know, my wife built those deer haunches. And he's like, well, I'm bringing them to New York. And so we worked it out to where we got tickets to see the show. Uh-huh. So,
that's funny. I got to visit my haunches.
Yeah, no program credit, but we're sitting there. And I forget which actor actually drug him on, but it's like they're dragging them on. Because it's like, if you do Lie of the Mind, you need half of a deer. That's one of the very specific props. And, you know, where are you going to find half a deer?
Only in a theater warehouse somewhere.
Yes.
But it was so much fun. And it's a mixed media project. So I you know, designed how the pieces would look and how it would be, you know, articulated. And, you know, so it doesn't look like, you know, like the legs bent at different angles. So it looked more realistic. And then laid it all up in lumber. And cut holes out strategically inside to reduce the weight of it, and then carved the form essentially, and built the hooves, painted the end where it would be cut, and then I went to a taxidermist to get a hide and talked to the taxidermist about like, what would it look like if a deer was cut in half, and applied the hide to the form. But so that was like so much fun to take all the different media and put it together in a way that looked realistic and, you know, great. I've always, my thing with props, and this is sometimes a problem, is that I always want things to look great close up as well as from a distance. You know, I really like a high degree of quality. And sometimes you know, the distance is the most important thing. But that's one reason that I think I loved the opera so much is because people have opera glasses. Our standard there is that it has to look great close up as well as from a distance. So that appeals to me a lot.
Yeah, I've always been a huge fan of, you know, close up at looking as realistic and as perfect as it can. Mm-hmm. Because in my mind, we're not only creating this for the audience, we're also creating it for the actors mm-hmm. to stay in that world. You know, if they're in a very dramatic scene and they're holding a letter and its scribbles are just funny lines written down, that's going to take them out of the world.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So that's always been my thought process for it as well. Also, I just realized we've all made deer.
Oh, yeah.
We need to start
That's one of those things.
It's the deer club. Like,
yeah.
Why not? Let's all make dead deer.
I have quite an extensive. Yeah, I have quite an extensive portfolio of dead stuff props.
You're right.
Yeah. Got it's a goose. One of the props that I made at the opera was a dead person, and it was really cool because
those are my favorites.
Yeah, because the dead person was the first light cue of the opera was a spot on my dead person prop, which I thought was crazy cool. It was a world premiere. It's like the first thing you see is my prop.
Woo. I love it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Now, you also, when you were in New York, did Sleep No More, right?
Yeah, I didn't work there. I just volunteered there for a couple of days. We had several friends that were working on it. And I think that was when I was going to Elon or had started at Elon, something like that. So I had some spare time.
It may have been over a winter break.
Maybe it was over a winter break. So yeah, so I had some spare time and they were asking for volunteers. So I was like, heck yeah, I want to go see what it's about and volunteered for that for a couple of days. So I had I upholstered the inside of a coffin was the project that I did. And that was cool, because that was done by a British design team and they tend to work a little bit differently in Europe, where designers don't quite spell everything out like we do in America. and the artisans who make everything and paint everything are more interpretive. Mm-hmm. And so the designer, you know, showed me the coffin and the fabric and they had a picture or two of sort of the general look. And then it was up to me to kind of make that happen, which was great. You know, I loved the freedom to play with it, you know, and like we talked about in the last episode, as artisans, you know, you're limited by your materials or mm-hmm. you work best when you're doing the things that the materials want to do. And so you're always making those kinds of materials discoveries. And so if you can like, okay, it's going to work really well to do this and then show the designer, versus, you know, just like make this happen or what.
Yeah. You know.
My favorite.
You're like, okay.
So yeah, I can't remember if I did anything else for Sleep No More, but yeah, mostly what I did was upholstered the inside of a coffin. It was like, it was all this complicated pleating.
Oh, nice.
It was fancy.
It was enough to get tickets to there.
Yeah.
To get free tickets to one of their, I think they were
previews.
It was previews.
A preview. Yeah. It was right before they opened.
Yeah.
And Sleep No More is an immersive theater as well, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you go through the space and as an audience member, you just wander and mm-hmm. actors perform these scenes moving through the spaces. So you can choose to follow an actor. You can choose to like rummage through the drawers of a room that you're in.
That would be me.
Yeah.
I'd be like, I'm a nibno, so I'm just going to go through all this.
Turn all the pictures around, look on the bottom of everything.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, that's how detailed it is that they've done, you know, everything is done to the degree where the audience can rummage, you know, so if you're rummaging through things, everything is going to be in period in the world. You know, you're not going to open it up and there's like a tag from Hobby Lobby or something. So it's pretty amazing.
I had the chance to work with them, but right before they asked me to come work for them, I just signed a contract for an off-Broadway show.
Mm.
And I just didn't have the time because I was also doing another show. Because, you know, in New York, you're doing 50 at once.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And so I was like, oh, no, maybe next time. And left the city mm-hmm. a few months after that.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I always wanted to do that one.
Did you get to go see it?
I know. It was always on the list to go see it, but it just never happened.
Maybe they'll do one out in on the West Coast.
Right? I'll start Los one. Angeles. I'll like start telling people, I'm like, you know, guys, what would be fun?
Mm-hmm. So one of the props I wanted to talk about, this is more towards the end of your props career in New York City. It was at Second Stage, and I think it was Susan Barris was props mastering, and she needed this very, very special prop for Zach Braff's show. And I forget how she approached. Did she describe it, and you were like, sure.
I think something like that, yeah. That was kind of at a funny time, too. So I had been out of the props game for a while because I assisted scenic designers on Broadway for a while. I did corporate design for a while. And when I got back into props, I did the thing that I tell my students not to do, which is that I said, yes, I can do things. It was like stuff that I had done before, but it had been a while and I was a little rusty, or it was like next level up. But I guess Dionysus was looking down on me or whatever, because each of the projects that I had sort of like let me get back into my skills and like step up to the next level. So I wasn't, I never had that moment that you don't want to have where it's like, no, I really can't do this. You know, I was able to like Google enough to be like, oh yeah, right. You know, I was kind of like back in the game. But yeah, so Susan reached out to me. I think it was one of those deals where, you know, again, like this is the perfect thing for me. She had all these props to get for the show. And then this one crazy one, and she just wanted somebody to take the one crazy one off her hands, and she could deal with everything else. I was like, perfect. So the prop was this. They're in the show, at this house that they're in, there's this piece of supposedly African art, but in reality, you find out that it's just some kind of like Chinese knockoff thing. And then an actress touches it, and the thing has to disassemble itself, but like with cues, because it has to be funny. And you know, funny is hard. Funny comes down to timing. So it's like, you know, one thing falls, beat, beat, another thing falls, beat, you know, everything falls. So it had to be timed out like that. Alexander Dodge was the scenic designer. And so he and Susan and I talked, and, the research that he had were of these kind of like, kind of a harp-like thing, so a rectangle structure that had twine on it with beads, and then it had like bottle caps and stuff, you know, so like modern, you know, trash worked in
almost like an abacus.
So I designed this sort of automaton. And nowadays, I think, you know, we have so many, like, people would use Arduino and wireless.
A few servos.
Yeah. No, like, wireless dimming, RX4 and all that kind of stuff to do it. But back then, that was just a little bit before that stuff was very common. So I got a little servo motor and lots of parts. And so I had dowels that had the beads on them, and then a servo motor turned a drive shaft, and on the drive shaft I had cams, which are circles with part of the circle cut out, and you know, when it would revolve around, the opening would let the dowel fall forward, so it was tilted on a bit of an angle, right? It would like push it out, and then you know, the beads would fall off the dowel, and then attached at the end of the drive shaft was a spool, and it pulled, this is crazy, right? It pulled a wire that pulled a pin. So the last little trick was after all the beads fell, then the whole thing tilted over like it was going to fall off. And I welded a stand to that would keep it straight. But then when the pin was pulled, the weight would pull it down to an angle. Yeah, it was pretty nuts.
Because it was sort of like, you know, it was the comedic moment where the actress touches it. And I think like one thing falls off and she's like, ooh, she takes her hand off. And then you take a step away and like two more beads fall off. Yeah. You're like, ooh, and you take like tiptoe three more steps away. And it's like four or five beads kind of come off. You're like, ugh. So you like turn around and you stop and it's not doing anything. Yeah. You're like, phew. And then as soon as you wipe your brow, the whole thing kind of like falls apart and all the beads come falling and the thing falls. So it was like this weird kind of like timed out.
And the crazy thing, you know, again, we have better tools to do this sort of thing now, but the whole thing was battery controlled and just operated with a switch. So the actress pushed the switch to start the whole process and then did the thing. But then she also had to push the switch to turn it off too. So the motor didn't just spin endlessly and burn itself out. So it was like, it did not have the degree of like fail safes involved that I would ideally like for a prop that's that important. Mm-hmm. But it worked. And then they took it to England because the show, after it closed its second stage, had another run. It toured, I think, a couple of places.
That's awesome.
That's the last out of, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's in a warehouse or in a landfill somewhere.
It was definitely crazy because it's like the kind of prop where if I was given it, I would be like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this.
And that's right? What Susan did.
Yeah. You're like, I'm not a magician.
Yeah. And I was freelancing. So I'm like, yes, of course I will do anything.
It's so true. When you're freelancing, you're like, yes, anything. I will figure it out.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But when you're in a shop, you're like, so-and-so is actually more equipped to do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, and again, like when you have a million props to get, because this thing took, I don't know, you know, like a couple of weeks. And then I also did some other stuff for her during that time. So mm-hmm. I think there were like a couple of days that we were waiting on materials and I did some shopping, you know, so it wasn't solid 2 weeks. And I don't remember if 2 weeks was right, but that was my main focus, you know, and that mm-hmm. was what I was doing at work for that amount of time. So I could just take that over and handle it, let her know what I needed. And then, you know, she was dealing with everything else. But it's hard when you're trying to tackle something that takes so much research and development, and you're still trying to, like, you know, get all of the letters and the glass and
mm-hmm. That's awesome, though.
It was fun.
So one thing that I'm really interested to hear more about are these masks.
Sure.
I'm not going to say it wrong.
The Commedia dell'arte mask.
Yes, the Commedia dell'arte.
Commedia.
You know what?
That's the close comedy enough,
masks
yeah.
that are made out of leather.
The art comedy mask.
The art comedy mask.
We're professionals with graduate degrees.
How you got into that and what brought you to Italy to study that in depth and still do that and kind of the process of it.
Yeah. So we did a little like weekend workshop on them in grad school. And that mm-hmm. was my first taste of it. And I learned just enough to do them badly. And then when I got my job here at Elon, one of the acting professors here, Kevin Otis, has a background in commedia and clown and that kind of stuff. And he was interested in developing that. So we mm-hmm. started this project together where sort of he taught me what he knew about commedia because I didn't know much about the performance side of it. And I taught him what I knew about mask making. And then we wrote and secured grants to do further study. So we got materials to work with, and then we got money to go to Italy. So he went and studied with someone who's mostly performance, but does a little bit of mask making. Mm-hmm. And then I went and studied with the one that's mostly mask making, any bit of performance. And mm-hmm. so to give you a little bit of history, I studied with Donato Sartori, who is now passed away. His father, Amuleto Sartori, sort of rediscovered these masks. So the techniques and the masks themselves had sort of been lost to his, and Amuleto, you know, took what he had and, you know, the way that it was described, in literature and stuff, and tried to recreate the process by which the commedia masks would have been made. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know for sure that this is exactly it, but the closest.
Oh. Yeah, I think because he would look at old paintings and prints of commedia from the 14th mm-hmm. and 15th century. Because mm-hmm. I think that this was outlawed. So it was outlawed for several hundred years, which is the reason why it disappeared.
Yeah.
No
masks. Catholic Church, not into masks.
So
makes sense.
Yeah. Unless you're doing a, like, pageant play for the Catholic Church and you're playing the devil and then wear a mask. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of details.
So there are some stories where he actually, you know, go to a museum and they might have a mask from the 14th century and he cut off a small piece of the mask to kind of bring back to his shop and analyze, like, what's this made out of? What chemicals did they treat it with? Yada, yada. like some serious detective work going on. But this mask workshop is fairly well known.
Yeah, it's really well known. It's been going on for several decades. And his wife and daughter, I believe, still carry it on. I think it's still ongoing.
And what's the workshop called?
It's at the International... Oh my God, I'm going to get it wrong. And it's also in Italian. But it's the Museum of Mask and Gestural Studies. And it's in Abano Terme, Italy, which is near Padua. And I think the website is maskmuseum.it, like that. And if you search for Donato, it'll come up for sure. But
I'm definitely looking this up.
If you ever had the Thurston James mask making book, he went to that workshop and basically cribbed his notes and made it into his own book.
Yeah. And it's amazing. It's, you know, they have feelings about how much information they share and what's secret. And I think that, as you know, it used to be that they were more secretive about it, but then in more recent years, they just want to make sure that the technique doesn't die out again. I don't feel like I haven't taught exactly that to anybody, for pay or anything like that. But, you know, 'cause I want to respect that they own the technique, but they get it out there a little bit more. But, so I was able to study with them for 5 weeks and learn about the history of the masks and what they're used for. And then we went out to the workshop and did it. So we cast our faces. We worked with clay to design a mask. And then the next step is that you carve the mask out of wood. And that piece is called the matrix. And then you wet the leather and stretch it around. And then you put the leather on the matrix, a complicated process of a lot of nails and stuff. And then there's, you know, several kind of steps of smoothing the leather down. And basically, you're just working with water. So when the leather dries out, it's pretty firm and holds its shape. And when it's wet, it's kind of like spongier and softer. Mm-hmm. And so each step of the process you're doing when the leather is at the right degree of moistness for that step. It's really complicated. You know, there's smoothing and then you hammer it with a hammer made out of horn and then you hammer it with a flat hammer. And, then there's, you know, a good bit of finishing work that goes into as well, putting a wire in the edge of finishing it out. And what you get is this beautiful, beautiful mask. And performers like to wear leather masks because it moves with their faces a little bit. Yeah. And it doesn't, you know, like if you can imagine wearing plastic against your face, the sweat. Yeah, exactly. It's just going to build up in there. But the leather lets the sweat sort of, you know, like evaporate through a little bit more. So it's more comfortable. And then, so Kevin, adapted The Servant of Two Masters, did a sort of American take on it. And, I designed masks for that show. And so our students were able to work in leather masks that were, you know, built for their characters and everything, which was pretty cool. You can certainly buy leather masks and they would be more generalized. So like, you know, this Arlecchino. And then you can also buy neoprene masks, which is a plastic material. You've got the sweat issue. So they're available, but it's really interesting. And it's kind of, I've always had this interest in historical techniques and historical materials. We were talking about this in the other episode a little bit about how materials, you know, if you're working in a way that the materials like to work, it's usually more successful than if you're trying to work against the material. And so I like learning about those materials. And a lot of times being informed by how people made shoes out of leather or how people built furniture or, you know, whatever that sort of historic craftsman skill was can really inform the work that we do in the theater. We have to shortcut so much because of time frames and, you know, resources or whatever. But if you have some competency in those skills, it gives you a broader range. And sometimes that historic craft is like a better way to go. You know, sometimes you shouldn't glue everything together with hot glue. Sometimes you'll have more success if you just like know enough to, you know, to get the thing that's more historic and less shortcutty, crafty. And so, yes. And I like to just like, you know, jump down the nerd rabbit hole of that stuff anyway and learn what I can for no real reason other than to appease my nerd.
I thought it was interesting when you came back because their techniques are based on what tools and materials they have available over in Italy. So you're already like, you can't necessarily get that over here. But they also refer to a lot of their materials and tools, not just by Italian names, but by kind of like shorthand and nickname kind of stuff. So it's kind of like being over here and you're like, yeah, give me a 2x4. And it's like, how much translation before you find out that that's supposed to be pine wood? So over there you get some, you know, like this is a blah, blah, blah. And you go on Google Translate and it's like, it's not giving you a direct translation. And you're like, I don't even know what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And I know I can't even get it over here. So how am I going to be able to recreate it? So then that process of trying to like do it when you come back the same way they were doing it.
Yeah. There. Well, that was a lot of my work actually after I got back was trying to make the process work for American, you know, what's available here. So I converted, you know, they also, they use paper mache as sort of the rough draft version of the mask. And they have this really cool way of doing paper mache that's really beautiful. And it's what they do for a Venetian mask, paper mache. But so I had to find what papers I could get over here that would do about the same. I had to figure out what kind of wood to get for the matrix that would do about the same thing. And then they, the health and safety aspects of what they did sometimes were a bit below my standards, that what I've learned over here, especially at the Santa Fe Opera. So I tried to change some of the materials to less toxic material, especially, you know, think about like glues and finishing stuff. When they make the mask out of clay, the whole thing is on clay. And I like to work off of a plaster form so you know where the person's face is, you know, but then it makes one of the other steps a little bit later more complicated. But so I sort of adapted the process that I learned there to make it workable in an American setting, you know, but still holding as closely to Donato's process.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've always been so intrigued by that process. I have a old professor, well, not old professor, a professor
former
from undergrad. Rephrase that. A professor from undergrad. And he, I think maybe like a year or two after I graduated, really got into mask making and in this specific form. And so it's so fascinating watching him on Instagram just making masks. Yeah, that's so cool that they still have these workshops you can go over to Italy and do.
Yeah, it was awesome. Amazing. I would recommend it to anyone. And there's lots of, you know, so it's like everybody that has studied with Donato that kept doing it has adapted that process for their own materials or the way they like to work or whatever. So you can get a whole spectrum of, you know, every student, like, you know, this is the way that this guy adapted the Sartori method. And this is the way that this person adapted the Sartori method. So there's a lot of kind of grandchildren of the process.
I think, a few years later when we were both in Santa Fe, Santa Fe has this international folk art festival. So people bring their folk art from all around the world and set up. You can walk around and see it. So we're walking around and we saw it was an Indonesian mask maker. So they had a lot of the traditional Indonesian masks. And then there was one mask that looked very much like a Commedia mask in their sort of style. And we sort of started talking with them, and Natalie especially was like, that looks a lot like a Donato Sartori mask or something like that. And the guy was like, yes, Sartori, I met him. He had taken the class too or
he's
something.
He's the guy, yeah.
Like they have these international mask conventions where they, you know, all the different mask traditions get
that's
together.
Like, you know, and all the puppet people know each other.
Yeah.
All the mask people know each other. That's awesome. Well, that is all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much, Natalie, for sitting down with us once again.
You're welcome. It was delightful.
And everybody, make sure to follow us on Twitter at SilkMache and email us with any questions or ideas at propspodcast@gmail.com. And make sure to subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play, or Spotify.
And check out our website at silkflowersandpapermachehearts.com, where you can find all of our old episodes, as well as a link to our Patreon page. With Patreon, you sign up to donate a small sum on a monthly basis to help support this podcast. And if you donate over a certain amount, we will thank you personally at the end of every episode. And we'd like to thank Jay Duckworth for doing just that.
Hey, Jay!
Happy shadow, woohoo! This has been another episode of Silk Flowers and
Paper Mache Hearts with your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. We'll see you next time.
Bye.